Sorry, I don't talk with my hands. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith. Most important thing that I can share with you is it hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink or do any dope since May the 11th, 1976, and for that I'm especially grateful. I'm glad to be here and glad to be sober, and it's always a privilege to be able to participate in my own recovery, and particularly Al-Anon. I'm Al-Anon friendly, and I always anytime I get an opportunity to be the token alcoholic around Al-Anons, well, it's a form of amends. And the one thing I do know that the alcoholics that hang around these Al-Anon conventions are pretty damn crazy, I'll tell you that. But they have to be in their glory because they're in the midst of the deal. And I appreciate everything that we've been able to enjoy this weekend, and the committee for inviting Sue and I, and Jerry for hosting me around yesterday, and certainly all of you. It's a most timely thing for me to be able to participate. God has a funny sense of humor. Because at this point in time in my life and my sobriety, I was going through a lot of Al-Anon pain. I mean, it's just what's really going on in my life. And God has this funny sense of humor that I give what I need. And I don't go to Al-Anon meetings. I'm not an Al-Anon. I'm just an alcoholic. Beyond me, how I've ever been able to figure out how an alcoholic can work the first step as an Al-Anon. I mean, we don't release. We just reject. But Sue and I have been blessed to work with a lot of young people, young AAs and young Al-Anons, and we've sponsored a lot of these young people for 10 years or more now. They came into Alcoholics Anonymous when they were 15, 16 years old. The guys that I've sponsored, and they're young AAs, and we've raised them like children, and. One thing about alcoholics, why the ego will revive itself after some period of time, and age has nothing to do with that. And at this point in time in our life, why I particularly have a number of young alcoholic guys who are sober 10 years or more, which puts them up around 25, 26 years old, and they know every damn thing there is to know. They've done everything there is to do, and they move past their sponsor and move past God right into self-control. And it just seems like, I mean, we've done these things, and I don't know how to sponsor people without getting emotionally involved. Maybe you can, but, how can you support somebody's life without becoming emotionally involved? And it just seems like that these things happen. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about these kind of releases and these kind of patterns and personalities and what have you, And so I'm having to go through a period of time right now where I've got to let the chickens walk, and I've got to release and let these young people that I've literally raised, Sue and I have literally raised in the program AA and Al-Anon, and let them go out there and find the big things in life and have their own surrenders. And I'm eternally grateful for this program and the program of Al-Anon, because it seems like when I need these things, why, they're available. When I need to learn how to live and let live, when I need to learn how to let people experience their own surrenders like I've had to, why, God puts me in a place where that's what it's about. And that's probably the most spiritual message that I can carry to you, that I've been here a little over 19 years, and the one thing I've stayed here long enough to do is to experience that phenomena. The phenomena of the answer when the student is ready, the teacher is there. And whenever I've needed something, why, you've always been there. And it isn't just the fellowship. It isn't just, somebody's hug or what step are you on? It's a whole picture of whatever I've needed, you've been there. As long as I've been willing to, see and believe and touch and feel and experience, and I'm forever grateful for that, and that's where I'm at today. Also, our daughter is lived in halfway around the world in Milan, Italy. She's been an Alateen, then up to Al-Anon, 19 years, and she's been over there for 9 years, or almost 9.5 years, and she started sponsoring people over there, and she sponsored people over there for 6, 7, and some of them 8 years now, and she's built her own little nest of program over there, and gone through all the changes and you know, the pain of trying to carry the message as she was taught into an area of very minimal structure and strength of the program, and she's built that and gone through her own pain and sponsors 6 or 8 young women over there over the past 9 years, and they have grown to a point where they're rebelling against her, and they're going to break off and start their own little deal, or they're going to drive everybody nuts, or they're going to, you know, their sponsor don't know anything, which is another area of her life where just last week Simone called her mother at 12:30 at night, and Sue got up and went in the other room, and I could hear Sue in there yelling, screaming, and talking, and, you know, doing a 12-step call, you know. And the next day I said, well, who in the hell was that newcomer you're talking to? And she said, that was your daughter. That was 12-stepping Simone Drum. And I thought, you know, isn't it an unbelievable thing that our family came to this program over 19 years ago. We've stayed in this program, and we've stayed together and perpetually and individually while we've gone along the path of recovery. And as we change, as we go through these things, it never ceases to amaze me that, you know, we have the answers. We have the answers available to us. And the miracle is that a little girl that come out of a living hell can call her own mother to ask for help about sponsorship, or about program functions, or about service. And by no means does Sue sponsor her, nor does Sue sponsor me. I want to get that straight. But on occasion, she has been able to shed a little light on things that has just been beyond my comprehension. I say, how in the hell did you know that? I went to my home group meeting Thursday night, and I got about 70 hard-headed, crazy, bent fenders sitting in there, guys. It's a men's stag. They are the most stubborn, selfish, self-centered bunch of a-holes I have ever seen in my entire life. They do not respect my time. They don't respect my effort. They don't respect anything that I do for the group. And they all know that I'm wrong. And they all know all my character defects, which means they can use them against me. When I'm trying to be caring and sharing and loving, while they take my character defects, turn them around, use them against me, and make it seem like I'm stupid and don't know anything. And I rain my wrath on them. I told them all they're headed for pain, and I'm getting out of the way. And I went home and felt guilty. And I asked Mother Superior Al-Anon, I said, I just rained my wrath on all these turkeys. I know they're headed for pain. Their ego is out of whack, and I'm just let them know tonight that I'm getting out of the way, and the ego is going to splatter, and I'm going to dodge all the stuff. And she said, well, honey, I think when I have to do that, that's just my way of release. But you just had to tell them, and now you can get out of the way. I thought, by God, that's pretty profound. I didn't even know I was doing that. And then I get here, and this other Al-Anon superior, she does some little thing like this. Whatever in the heck that is, that's some kind of an Al-Anon symbol for relief. But Thursday night, I did something like this. And ain't it great? Ain't it great? I grew up in an alcoholic family. I come from a long line of alcoholics and alcoholism. To my knowledge, prior to me coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know anybody in my family that openly said they went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I understand my grandpappy went, but it was a secret because nobody believed he was going to stay sober, so they didn't want to publicize that he'd gone for help and then him be a failure. So, and he was. He didn't stay sober, and he died drunk. And my grandmother taught school for 54 years and never missed a day because of illness. She taught generations. She retired in Oklahoma as a school teacher. She taught fifth grade. And she retired in Oklahoma and came to Texas. And at that time, you could teach past some age there. And she taught school for 54 years. Retired in two different states, Oklahoma and Texas. She was the backbone of the whole family. She was an enabler. She worked. She made the money. She educated people. Even the alcoholics in our family controlled their drinking based on her approval. And then when she passed on, why, my father and I both got blitzing drunk, and our disease progressed whenever that intimidation or that need to please her was gone. And so the disease just rolled on. And my father's an alcoholic, and he ended up coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. He did go through a couple of treatment things. I helped him get in treatment while I was drinking. Because he was a bad drunk, and he needed help. And I even went to see him a couple of times when he was in treatment. And, of course, I was drunk, but I wasn't bad, as he was. He was sloppy drunk. And I took my wife and my kid and my dog and my cat to see my dad while he was in treatment. And everybody was nuts. And he didn't stay sober, and I didn't stay sober. And ultimately, on May the 11th, 1976, I ended up... going to Alcoholics Anonymous through a 12-step call. I had been to Alcoholics Anonymous prior to that. I'm not one of the people that came to Alcoholics Anonymous and stayed sober from my first meeting. I went in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for over 4 years, more out than in. I want to share with you that one of the most scariest experiences that I have ever had in my entire life is coming out of a blackout and recognizing I'm in the middle of an AA meeting. I'm a blackout drinker, and I've come out of a lot of blackouts in places that scared the bejesus out of me. But I did not want to know how I got there. And when I came out of a blackout sitting in the middle of an AA meeting, I did not want to know who brought me there. I looked around to see if there's anybody I recognized, and there wasn't, so somebody had to be waiting outside for me. And she was. My wife used to take me to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and wait outside with a 12-inch butcher knife. And she took me to a meeting where there was one door in and one door out, and it was the same door, so I couldn't escape. Times I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I looked around the room, and I wouldn't have drank with anybody in there, so I went across the street and sat on the curb and waited till the meeting's over. And if you want to know what loneliness is, by golly, that's loneliness. If you're so whatever the disease would call it at that time, I could not identify, and I sat in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, half drunk, got up and went across the street, sat on the curb and waited till the meeting was over by myself, because I was just, I wouldn't say I was better than them, I wouldn't say I was more hopeless than them, I just didn't fit. And I couldn't identify with what was going on. I couldn't hear anything, couldn't see anything. I'd get up from meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous half drunk and go get half sober. There was one time they took me to one of these marathon things. They have them things where they have meetings and meetings and meetings for 3 or 4 days. I remember one time I got up at 4 o'clock in the morning and got drunk. By 6, I was drunk, and I went to an alcathon meeting drunk, sobered up in an AA meeting, left the AA meeting about 9, went and got drunk, came back to the AA meeting drunk at 10:30, sobered up, and went back and got drunk again. 3 times during the course of AA meetings, I got drunk and sober, and sobered up. And I don't know if I felt like I was one of the unfortunates or not, but I felt like something's wrong, I'll guarantee you. And yet I did not have the ability to change that. That's just the way it was. It isn't. I know that you can't hear until you can hear. And I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just one of the kind of drunks. When I get thirsty, I drink. So when I was sitting, didn't make any difference if it was an AA meeting or in church or whether it was in a business meeting or whether it was by myself. When I wanted to drink, I drank, and I'd get up and go drink. Consequently, I believe today that there's no such thing as a help, or, you know, as a hopeless alcoholic. As long as they're breathing, there's a chance that he'll sober up or she'll sober up. And so I don't write them off. As long as they're still breathing, well, there's a chance. You never know when that they're going to sober up. And I'm grateful that people believed in me for that respect. And I ended up, didn't pick the day, wasn't anything special. Sue says that I tried to screw up Mother's Day. because May the 11th is always close to Mother's Day, and she said you had to pick that time because it's your AA birthday, and so it has to, we have to take a big deal over that instead of Mother's Day. But I didn't intentionally sober up close to Mother's Day. I didn't intend to sober up, to tell you the truth. And if I had have picked a day, it would have been something like Christmas or something, you know, with a significant time. My daddy never could remember my birthday, my belly button birthday, because he was a drunk, and God has a funny sense of humor. He sobered up on August 27th, 18 years ago, and that happens to be my belly button birthday. And he always remembers my belly button birthday now because it's his sobriety date. And so God has a funny sense of humor. I sobered up close to Mother's Day, and my dad sobered up close to Father's Day. Whatever. You know, he's still sober, and he's just my daddy, and we have a good relationship today. He's about 80, and he's going through a period of time right now. He got married, and now he's getting a divorce. And a divorce is just as painful at 80 as it is at 20. By the same token, I have Sue and I, Friday, had our 33rd wedding anniversary, and I always tell my daddy, said, you know, divorce may be painful, but staying with somebody 33 years ain't easy either, you know. But we have a good relationship, my father and I, because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love my dad, and he loves me, and we have a good relationship. So my family, just because we all came to the program and we all got a program and we're all still in the program, those of us that are alive and living, is not without pain. Sue's mother, my old crime partner, Fawn, old Fawn, God, I loved old Fawn, she always took my side. And when I came to the program and sobered up, why then I said, I'm an alcoholic. Well, she said, oh, something's wrong with you, and I don't want to have anything to do with it. And because I sobered up, now whenever I was beating the hell out of her daughter, why, she was on my side. But when I sobered up and quit doing that, she didn't want to have anything to do with it. And she didn't want to have anything to do with Sue. And Sue hadn't talked to her in, what, 16 years, 13 to 16 years. And so that doesn't, just because my family, my side of the family came together because of Alcoholics Anonymous, doesn't necessarily mean that the other side of the family came together. And we believe that it's, you know, we're here and we're not going to water down our program because somebody chooses not to. And those are the way things are. We've been able to deal with those issues because of the program of AA and Al-Anon, but it does not mean that we don't go through pain and we don't go through some concern for people and the difficulty of letting them live the life that they want to. You know, we have found out that if somebody wants to do that, just like her mother, the fact that she doesn't want anything to do with us has nothing to do with how much we love her. You taught us that. And the fact that my daughter's halfway around the world does not keep me from having pain. The fact that some guy, a young guy that came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous at 15 years old, and I literally raised him for 10, 11 years, wants to go back out on them streets and do whatever he's got to do, or wants to, you know, walk away from the program, does not keep me from having pain for that person. I'm a human being today. I drank so I wouldn't have those kind of feelings. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I in and out and in and out and in and out and finally came here and said, God help me. And I asked a total and complete stranger for help, and a little guy by the name of Jack Callahan. Little Jack always reminds me. I talk to him every Tuesday, and little Jack last Tuesday asked me where I was going, and I told him I was coming to Dallas, and he said, be sure and tell those people you wouldn't have anything to say if it weren't for me. And he's right. I love him, because he took time out of his busy schedule and came over to our house and 12-stepped me and put me in a detox and then spent time with my family, and he explained to my family that he'd seen me in and out of AA. And he explained to my family that an alcoholic of my type is not going to be able to go home to an old idea and stay sober. Because Sue and I had patterns. We've been together for 13 years, and we had patterns. And I'd come home, she'd start an argument, and then I'd, you know, respond. And then she'd argue some more, and then we'd have them fights, and then I'd go get drunk. And I couldn't stay sober under those conditions. In and out, in and out, in and out. And I could not stay sober under those conditions. And with the same token, they told us, that drinking is my problem, not her problem. And consequently, Sue would drink a little bit now and then. And I'd come home, and I'd be trying to stay sober, and I'd come home, I'd kiss her. She had alcohol in her breath. I said, "You're drinking." She said, "Yeah, I can drink." "You can't drink." And I said, "By God, I can't." And I'd go get drunk. See? And so all those patterns that were going on in our life, those things we were bumping into that kept that insanity going, were still there. We never could change, because for the 4.5 to 5 years that I was in and out of AA, Sue never went to Al-Anon. The kid never went to Alateen. I'm over here trying to stay sober, and I'm trying to do it. And of course, I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, "All right, Alcoholics Anonymous is about not drinking. You take care of my not drinking, but don't bother the rest of my life. I'm doing fine." And consequently, I didn't change. What I know today is that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I tried to work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and this program based on the second half of the first step. The second half of the first step says that my life is unmanageable. Now, I know I'm powerless. I've known I'm powerless over alcohol for years. I knew that. Matter of fact, I moved right on in some other narcotics to prove that, you know, I could be powerless even more, crazier. It got to the point where it was just, you know, when I became predictable, well, I just did something else so I could become unpredictable again. I knew I was powerless over that. But my thinking about power, the alcoholic thinking about power, our perception of power is, yes, I know I'm powerless over alcohol. That is not a problem. My problem is the unmanageability of my life, because there's a strange thing about my kind of an alcoholic. I get drunk just the same number of times I sober up. I get drunk and then I sober up. So when I sober up, I've got the guilt. Now that's what I'm powerless over. That's my perception of this. Now I've got the guilt, it's tearing me up. I got the shame, it's tearing me up. So I go get drunk, and then it goes away. Then I recognize I'm powerless over alcohol, but okay, I won't drink. So I try to not drink, and now I'm powerless over the guilt and remorse. So I got this confusion going into my head. Yes, I know I'm powerless over alcohol, but I'm not going to drink. And I would sit in front of my loved ones and say, "I'm not going to drink again. I'll swear on a stack of Bibles, go down to church, they'll baptize me, sprinkle me, dip me, and I'm not going to drink anymore." Then I'd sit down there with all these self-righteous people who were looking at me like, "Well, now you're sober, what are you going to do about all these problems?" And I'd have the guilt and remorse, so I'd have to go drink. It was the guilt and remorse that caused me to go drink, because I know I'm powerless. Knowing that I'm powerless over alcohol has nothing to do with it. I knew I'm powerless over alcohol. See? When I needed money, I robbed a guy, stuck a gun at the back of his head, took his billfold out. And I thought, I'm in control here. But I'm not. He's got me. I don't have him. He's got me. See? I've got the guilt and remorse. I don't have the ability to deal with the guilt and remorse or the shame. And so I drank. So it became a merry-go-round. You talk about the merry-go-round of denial. The alcoholic of my type had this merry-go-round. Now I got the guilt and remorse. What answers to the guilt and remorse? I drink. I'm powerless over alcohol. Don't you understand? But if you'll control my guilt and remorse, I won't have to drink. So it's just this constant thing. Until the phenomenon of craving gets so bad that I don't even have the ability to even comprehend where I'm at. And so I went to some point where I was never sober. It takes 90 days of clean, complete sobriety before you're sober. And I never went 90 days in the last 4.5 years without something in me. And so it just became a cycle. And so I would try to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd say, "Yes, I'm powerless over alcohol. I know I'm powerless over alcohol. So, Alcoholics Anonymous, here is my alcohol problem. Now, I'll work on the fact that my life's unmanageable, okay?" And then I'd run out here and see all this unmanageability, and I'd try to fix it, and it'd get worse. So I'd have to drink. And I'd go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd say, "What happened? I gave you my alcohol problem. You didn't fix it." And they'd look at me like them old-timers look at me like, "Keep drinking and you'll get here." Whenever I'd come in and I'd say, you know, "Take my alcohol problem," and they'd say, "Keep drinking, you'll get here, kid, if you don't die." I didn't understand it. I'd go back and try to work on the problems in my life. And I had a lot of problems. I'm the kind of alcoholic that had lots of problems. Lots of problems. When I sobered up May 11, 1976, I owed over $250,000 to people. You can't write them a letter and say, "I'll send you $100 a month. I had two different groups of people that was going to kill me. I had a woman that was trying to kill me, a kid that was you know, running around the house like a duck in Target. I had a 120-pound German Shepherd dog that attacked me every time I sat in one place more than 3 minutes. I had a cat that screeched through the house and clawed and scratched at everybody. Had neighbors that were constantly over there trying to blow up something or kill somebody. And I lived in an area where it was like a combat zone. And I'm trying to get things together. Don't you understand? I'm the only one in the whole damn neighborhood that's really seriously trying to get things together. And the whole world's out of step. Don't you understand? I'm not wrong. I understand perfectly what's right. It's just that everybody else is wrong. And that's a big load. It's a big load. Makes you thirsty. And in my case, I had to take some amphetamines because I had to do about 140 hours worth of work in 24. And so I needed a little help. And so I was just absolutely stark, raving nuts. And when I finally crawled out of that old motel room where I'd been in since January, I'd been in holdup the 9th of January, 1976. And I crawled out of there on the 6th of May, 1976. Came back home. Everybody split. They run away. And this guy, through a 12-step call, came and got me and put me in a detox. Now, I don't have any big deals about that other than the fact that's my story. But the good news was it's the first time when people tried to take me to AA or I tried to go to AA where I could walk in or walk out, I couldn't sit still. And so when they captured me on May the 10th, they captured me. And they took me at a very vulnerable moment, which I believe is what the book says. There comes a time, and we call it the what happened. You know, what it used to be like, the what happened, and then what it's like today. Well, my what happened was that some alcoholics who'd seen me ricocheting around AA for 4 or 5 years, they were tricked. They didn't know who they were going to get, because if they'd have known it was me, they wouldn't have come, because I was shooting up the place. But they were tricked, because you got to trick an alcoholic, you know. You got to make them think they're going to go over and 12-step somebody impotent. And so they told them somebody impotent, and then they got there and found out it was me, and they couldn't leave because I had a gun on them, wouldn't let them run. And so I took a hostage when they got there, and then I gave up, which is what alcoholics do. You know, we stick a gun in your face, say you got to help me, and then we give up. And so I tricked them, and they thought then that I was ready, and I didn't know whether I was or not, so I went with them. And they took me and put me in this place where they locked me up. And an amazing thing, I sobered up. And then I couldn't get away. And then they explained to me what was wrong with me. They said, you've got to understand that you're powerless over alcohol. Don't worry about the second half of that first step yet. Just take the first half of that first step. And that's one of the most important things to my entire... It's the most important part of my sobriety today. It's the most important thing that I understand about controlling people, about trying to take hostages and manipulate people, places and things, is that I have to go to the first half of that first step. I am powerless. Isn't it a strange thing that the first step in Al-Anon is exactly the same as it is in Alcoholics Anonymous? I am powerless over alcohol. Until I could come in here and say I am powerless over alcohol and get the full drift of the meaning of that. I am powerless. You are powerless. I cannot control my drinking. I can't control anything else. I am powerless, and I just ask a total and complete stranger to help me. A guy I wouldn't even drink with. And I followed him like a little chicken. Me. And to my innermost self. And I ended up in that place. And this guy had put me in there. And I didn't run away. And I stayed there. And I listened to him talk about powerless. I stuck a double-barrel shotgun underneath the guy's chin one time, raised him up on his toes, and took his billfold out of the back of his pocket. A big old long billfold. I robbed a poker game. And these guys had a lot of money, me and two other guys. And when I raised him up, I took the billfold, and then I looked at him, and then I cocked another trigger. It was a double hammer thing, and I cocked the other trigger so he could hear the sound. And the guy wet himself. And I had a feeling of power. I've got this man's life in my hand. And yet, you see, he had me. I didn't have him. And when I sit down there in that detox and I looked around, I understood something. I am powerless. I am powerless over people, places, and things. I'm powerless over everything. My whole life is unmanageable. Not just one area. It was a moment of clarity, whatever you want to call it. I don't remember that it happened at a certain time or whatever, but I admitted to my innermost self that I am powerless. I don't know anything about anything. I don't know anything about my life. I don't know anything about you. I'm a total loss, a complete failure as a father, as a husband. There is not one area of my life that I can tell anybody. When I did that inventory of that period of time and look back on my life, I am totally and completely a loss to everything. It turned out that my doctor was a guy by the name of Paul Olliger, Dr. Paul. His story's in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He happened to be my doctor. He was working at that detox at that time. And Paul came in after I'd been there a couple of days and asked me if there was a point in my life that I felt like I was worth something. Now, that was a strange thing to ask me, because I didn't really believe that I was worth anything. But sitting there 3 days sober, without any kind of medication, and they didn't detox me with any medication or anything, but sitting in that detoxification, my family's gone, everything's gone, I have no visible means of support, I have no job, I have nothing, it's all gone. I have people after me, but that doesn't make any difference. This man asked me if there was ever a time in my life that I felt like I was worth something. And I remembered I was locked up when I was 15 years old. I was locked up because I was a troubled kid, and I was locked up with about 300 other troubled kids. And at the end of a period of time, why, they had sports activities and various other things, but they had a vote, and for the most popular person. You had to have good grades, you had to be participating in the sports that they had in this lockup. It was kind of like for juvenile kids, and I was 14, 15 years old, and they had me locked up, and I won the most popular kid 2 years in a row. Never been done before or since. Nobody's ever done it in the history of that. 2 years in a row, I won the most popular kid. Now, that was scholastically, academically, everything. I was in a confined, locked-up environment. You got to understand, I was in prison, and I was the most popular kid. Now, that ain't bad. That's all I could tell. And I told Dr. Paul, I said, that's the only time in my life I was locked up there for 2 years, and people believed in me. I mean, I was a leader in there. And that's all I can remember. But I said, you know, today here I am, and years and years later, and I got nobody. And he said, well, why don't you try to hold on to that? Why don't you try to hold on to that? And I did. 2 days, 3 days sober, I held on to it. There was a time in my life. There was a time in my life that I was worth. Somebody believed in me. There was a time in my life when somebody believed that what I was doing, or I could help somebody. I could help somebody. That was the deal. I was trying to help these other kids. I would say, it's going to be all right. It doesn't make any difference. Your mom and dad don't love you. And you're mine. We're together in here. I thrived on fellowship at 15 years old with these other troubled kids. I would convince them of that. There was something inside of me that said, yeah, we'll make it. Together we'll make it. Now, I don't know where any of those kids are today. I didn't have any. But there was a time in my life whenever people believed in me. And I believed in me. Because I was doing God's work. Even in a penitentiary, locked up with these other people. And I believe that all of us have a time in our life when we believe that we're doing something that God wants us to do. There is a reference point in all of our life, irregardless of the pain, the confusion, the powerlessness, the total and complete defeat. There's still a time in our life that we can look at where we know beyond a shadow of a doubt we were doing the right thing and somebody voted. And I held on to that 3 days sober. And I built a foundation of over 19 years on that. That's not an egotistical thing. I was 36 years old. I lost everything. I'd been married and divorced. I had everything that a human being could possibly want. I'd been offered to me and given to me. I'd taken it and abused it, destroyed it because of the alcoholism. And when those kids voted on me in that boys' home thing, alcoholism was full-blown in my life at 15 years old. That's why I was there. I was locked up because of alcoholism at 15 years old. I could have sat in any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and qualified at 15 years old. And yet I didn't. That was not a point. It was the fact that somebody believed in me. It was the fact that I was doing something right in my life at that time. It wasn't important to me to hold on to that. I got a trophy for it. There was a plaque for it. Many times later, where I might have thought about it, I might have sat down and talked to somebody about it, but it was just a point in time, and it went away. At 36 years old, I ended up in a detoxification unit, been in and out of failure in Alcoholics Anonymous for 4 to 5 years, and I'm sitting in front of a doctor who's a medical doctor, and he's also an alcoholic. And he asked me, is there a point in my life whenever I was worth something? And I ask you this morning, is there a point in your life when you was worth something? You know, maybe it was today. Maybe it was 100 years ago. And I ask you that for a simple reason. I share with you a story about a family, a father and a mother and a little girl. They lived in Europe. And all their life, their dream, everybody has dreams. You had a dream. They wanted to do something. They wanted to do that. A special dream. We all have special dreams. A place you want to go. Something they wanted to see. And this family, a good family, the father loved the mother loved the father. They loved their little girl just as much as anything that you could possibly love. Good people. They wanted to come to America. A dream to come to America. And so they decided to make a pact. They'd save all their money, they'd work as hard as they could, and they'd save their money so they could come to America. And they saved and saved and saved, and came the day they could buy the ticket. And they wanted to go on a great ocean liner. And they went down and they bought their ticket, and then they were excited about that, and they made their plans to come the day that the great ocean liner was going to sail to America. And because it was a dream, it was something they wanted to do, well, they held on to that. It was a point in time. It was something going to come true. Something good in their life was going to come true. And they worked hard as a family, and they held on to each other. And they went down and took all their belongings, everything they had, they packed it, and they went down and got on the great ocean liner, and they sailed. They looked out the porthole and watched the land go away, and they're sailing 3 or 4 days. They stayed in that room. And all they could think about was the dream. The pictures they'd seen, everything was a fantasy, but it was a dream, and the dream was coming true. And every day, they would eat what they brought. And the only thing that they brought was crackers and cheese, because that's all they had. They didn't spend a lot of money on other food. They had crackers and cheese, and every day they'd break this open, this little picnic basket or what have you. You can imagine it, and they'd sit there, and as a family, loved each other, and they're making their trip, their dream's coming true, and they'd sit there, and they have crackers and cheese. 4 days out, the little girl said, "Daddy, Daddy, I got to have something else to eat. I just can't make it on crackers and cheese." And the father, being a good father, said, "Okay, here's a nickel. Go up to the galley and get an ice cream cone." The little girl left. She's gone 2 hours. The mother's worried to death. The father's scared. He didn't know what happened to the little girl. The mother and father sat in that room for 2 hours, just worried, sick about the little girl. And pretty soon, knock at the door, the little girl comes back, and she comes in, she's got a grin, ear to ear. The father said, "Where have you been? For goodness sake, you've been gone for 2 hours. Your mother and I have been worried sick." She said, "Oh, Daddy, Daddy, I've been up in the galley. I went up there, and I had steak and potatoes, and I had 2 ice cream cones. And the father said, "How can you have all that for a nickel?" She said, "Oh, the food's free. It comes with a ticket." God's free, it comes with a ticket. Mm-hmm. God's free, it comes with a ticket. Don't settle for crackers and cheese. Mm-hmm. Don't do that. Don't do that to yourself. That isn't what we come... I didn't come to this program for crackers and cheese. I came to the program with crackers and cheese. That's a story about teachers. The mother and father loved each other. They loved that little girl, but ignorance does not substitute where love can't go. They wanted everybody to have... Everybody was supposed to have a good time. It was a dream come true. Because they couldn't understand. Because they couldn't read the directions. Because they were so into themselves that their dream was coming true that they couldn't enjoy the whole package. Is there anything that you've done for me as you've opened my eyes so that I can enjoy the whole package? I don't have to settle for the crackers and cheese. I came here. Oh, it's not without pain. I've been through a lot of pain in sobriety. A lot of the pain that I've gone through in sobriety is because I've had to walk back through every rotten, dirty thing I ever did while I drank. Every rotten, dirty thing. Every rotten, dirty thing I ever did drunk, I had to go back to and look at it from the other side. And I know today that the reason I had to do that is because it's the only way I could do my 8-step list. See? But once I came here and I took the first half of that first step and said, I am powerless, I could go on and understand the unmanageability of my life. And I could go on into those character defects. And I could understand that little by little. And you know, it's an amazing thing. There's an amazing thing about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The more I read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about powerless. It talks about here we are, now we're sober, now we're going to control people. Now we're going to fix the relationships. Isn't it an amazing thing? Isn't it amazing that an alcoholic sobers up and he has Al-Anon syndrome? I mean, that's all it's. I mean, gonna go out here and I'm gonna sponsor. So I'm gonna sponsor good. I'm gonna be the best sponsor. I'm gonna control every alcoholic that I sponsor. God has a funny sense of humor. You can't control an alcoholic, drunk or sober. Okay. And so I have to learn these principles. I have to learn these principles. One of the biggest surrenders I've had in sobriety is to be able to understand, wake up one morning and understand how needy I am. How needy. God, I hated that word. Oh, that's an Al-Anon word. Al-Anons are needy. Alcoholics are not needy. See? We're powerful. And I woke up one morning, I was powerfully needy. I could not believe how much I needed your approval. For God's sakes, I'm a man. You know, I don't need anybody's approval to feel good about me. And it amazed me. I had made a sponsor the most powerful thing on the face of the earth. And that I needed that sponsor's approval just to walk down the street and hold my head up. And I thought, my God, I've done it again. And then when I looked at that relationship with a sponsor, I turned around and looked at what I'd formed with the people I sponsor. And they needed my approval. And I'd done it to them. And I had to come to understand that there's no God in that. Mm-hmm. See? And how I'd misconstrued the tools. And I'd one more time made heroes and made people perfect. And all that is for my kind of an alcoholic is just set up so I can drink. That's all it is. It's just a set up so I can drink. I'm disappointed. You have screwed over me. You've disappointed me. I'm going to go drink. And all it is a drink. And I could come back to the first half of that first step and say, I'm powerless over alcohol. That every time I set these things up in my life, every time I switch the obsession in my life, all it is that I'm just setting myself up so that I can get those feelings back inside of me and go drink. And so it's just a drink. And so I had to stop a lot of things when I sobered up. I've not hit that lady in over 19 years. I remember she got in my face when I stayed out to too many meetings. I came home and she got in my face, yabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dab. I remember looking at her saying, you know, I'm not going to fight with you anymore. I can't hit you and stay sober. You're going to have to fix yourself. And it was like, whoa! And I turned around and walked off. I walked away from it. And I thought, isn't there something in the Bible or something that says turn the other cheek? Some crap like that. I think that's just what I did. And I walked away because I could not have that physical bond. The amazing thing about it is in the 11th chapter in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about the alcoholic sobers up and then we're like a rubber band and then we twist and we turn and we twist and we turn as we back into sobriety. So here I am, I'm a physically violent kind of a drunk, and then I sober up and I can't hit people anymore. What happens? It goes inward. My wife looked at me and said, you're not going to wuss out on me, are you? See, because I completely changed and all that went inward. We just went inward. All of a sudden here I'm this, you know, macho guy that's running around punching and ventilating, and all of a sudden here I sober up and I can't do that anymore, and all of a sudden I'm a different person and it's going inside. Now that drives the family crazy because they're used to this animal that's screeching and clawing and kicking around here, and all of a sudden I'm a wuss. All of a sudden, it's inside of me, and all of a sudden, I'm sitting here. You know? And all of a sudden, at some period of sobriety, it's like battery acid, and I'm dying inside. Because I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to take care of that. all of a sudden I'm dying inside because I can't ventilate and I'm stuffing. And thank God for the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God for sponsorship that recognized that even though I had nothing to give away, there was somebody who had less. And he sent a guy to me. I was standing around AA dying inside. My wife's going to Al-Anon, the kids going to Alley Teen, the dog's going to Alley Dog, the cat's going to Alley Cat, you know, they're just going, and I'm dying, I'm sober, I'm dying. I'm not going to drink, I'm just going to implode. And I'm bleeding out every opening in my body. I put 9 pints of blood back in me. And my old sponsor come along and sent a guy into my life to ask me to be his sponsor. And he came up and asked me to be his sponsor. And even, you know, the alcoholic ego is the most unbelievable thing. I got nothing to give away. I'm dying. I'm 3 years sober. I'm standing around a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with a grenade. I'm holding on to a grenade. Bob the cop gave me a dummy grenade. And he said, probably the closest thing to a spiritual experience you're going to have is you put this in your mouth and pull the pin. And I was standing around Alcoholics Anonymous with this grenade, radiating hate, 3 years sober, with absolutely nothing to give away. And my sponsor sent a moron over and asked me, told this guy, he said, go ask him to be your sponsor. And he didn't know anything different to do, and he came and asked me to be his sponsor, and I said, I don't know, I'll have to ask my sponsor, hold my grenade. You know? And I went over to this guy, and I said, my sponsor, and I said, see him? And he said, yeah. I said, well, he asked me to be his sponsor. And my sponsor said, yeah, I know. I sent him over there. You go over there and tell him you'll be his sponsor and do exactly what he says. And that don't make sense to me today. See? And that was, I look back on that now, and that was an Al-Anon trick. See? You go back and tell him you'll be his sponsor and do exactly as he says. Now, that sounds like something my wife would say to me. You know? Don't even make sense. But I didn't argue with my sponsor, because when you argue with him, they go crazy and embarrass themselves, and I didn't want to embarrass my sponsor, so I went back and took my grenade back and said, my sponsor says I got to be your sponsor. What do you want to do? And he said he wanted to go out and have a ride in my car. And I took him out and got him in my car, and he started talking 666 stuff to me. And then he'd say, do you ever do anything like that? And I said, yeah, I did some stuff like that. And so I'm the alcoholic, and I'm his sponsor. I'm not going to let him one-up me. So I told him a bunch of sick stuff that I'd done. And he said, you're sick. You're sick. You're sick. I'd heard that before, because my sponsor and my wife had always told me about that. And so now this guy that I sponsor is telling me that. And so instead of arguing with it, three is the vote, so I figured it must be right. And so we went to meetings, and I started taking that guy to meetings, and ultimately he came to my house and did the steps with me, and we got on our knees together, and we did the steps together. And it is an amazing thing. When one alcoholic helps another alcoholic, strange things happen. They both change, because that's the kind of combination that's necessary to put God in there. And it became a God consciousness in that home, because I brought another alcoholic in there and started trying to help him. There was no God consciousness completely in that home, even though the Al-Anon had probably had God consciousness, the Alateen had God consciousness. It became a family when the alcoholic got God consciousness helping another alcoholic. And therefore it was one. It made full circle. The good news is, as long as the Al-Anon and the Alateen were trying to work on their program individually, there was never a time in that house when there was no God consciousness. That is why it's so important for the families of to try to work a program, because even though there's active drinking, there has to be some God consciousness in that home, or there cannot be any recovery. And as long as there was all that insanity and the active disease in that home, then there was no God consciousness, there was no foundation, there was no hope, there was no trust, there was no belief. And once we came to the program and the Al-Anon and the Alateen started getting some God consciousness in there, it rolls over. And I wanted what they had. And it became an attraction. I'll tell you something. Everything in my life that has been conducive to my sobriety, the Al-Anon and the Alateen has done first. Everything, now this is my story, everything in my life that has been conducive to sobriety, the Al-Anon and the Alateen has done first. And the reason I can say that is because alcoholics are riddled with fear. My kind of alcoholic is riddled with fear. The Al-Anon are chargers. They get it, away they go. They did the first step first. They did the fourth step first. They did the fifth step first. They got involved in service first. They did all these things first. Everything they did first, because I'd sit back and judge it and be scared to death of it. And when they go do it, I'd follow. And from that, I found out that every good thing in my life is preceded by a wall of fear. Every good thing in my life is preceded by a wall of fear, and I'd have to walk through those walls of fear. But ain't it great that the family was involved in recovery, and so they'd go through those walls of fear, and I could see the recovery on their side, and that helped me walk through the same thing, because of the same thing. I had to go through that fourth and fifth step. They went through the fourth and fifth step, came back, and didn't die. See? And I know they were talking about the same thing over there when they did their fifth step I'm going to talk about, because we'd done it together. See? And they walked through those walls of fear and came out on the other side, and good things happened. And we've grown together. We've been able to be a full family. And I know today that the willingness to do these things, because we've taken that first half of that first step. That is the most important thing. You cannot go on. Please don't settle for the crackers and cheese. Please don't run in there and try to get your life fixed if you haven't admit the powerlessness. Because everything else is going to be out of step if you do. That's why I know, as far as sponsorship, when I have to learn to live and let live with the people that I sponsor, the pain that I go through, because the 19 years, the curse of being an old-timer is you can see what's down the road when they can't, and you're headed down the road and you can see it. And yet I got to love them enough to let them go. I've got to love them enough to let them go. I've got to believe that God's in my life, God's in your life, because it's been in my family's life, because I've seen those things happen. I got to believe that what my daughter's doing today in her life is what she's supposed to be doing. She called up last Monday full of pain because the babies were taking off and going to go run out and get in all kinds of painful situations, and she was trying to soften that pain. And what she got from her mother is, "Baby, turn around, because there's somebody coming off the wall over here that needs what you got." And she turned around, and there was a little girl from Czechoslovakia that was right there that needed the help that she had. See, and that's the God consciousness. When we let go and let God, we turn around and there is someone that God wants us to help, that we can help and has the identity. And you've taught me that. Al-Anon's taught me that. I read the Al-Anon One Day at a Time book every morning along with my other meditation, because I sponsor people, because I work with people, because I interact with people. I'm grateful for the old-timers that have talked to me about God. I'm grateful for those teachers, because I need to talk about God. I need to know that there's a God in my life and He wants me to be free. I need to know that there's a God in my life and He's working, and it's all His business, not mine, that I'm just a servant. I need to know that's okay. I need the people that have gone before me, the people that will talk to me about and keep in mind that what this is all about. This is a spiritual way of life. See, and what I've come to understand, that's the difference between spirituality and religious. It's very simple. Religion is for people who are afraid of going to hell. Spirituality is for those of us who've been there. And I need to know the people who've been through their hell and walked through their pain and their surrenders, and they're walking ahead of me. And they're the teachers, not the heroes. Not the heroes. My heroes have always been cowboys. But the teachers. And the way they teach is that by their example. What you do speaks so loud I can't hear a word you say. And it's their teachers, by their experiences. And their experiences give me the strength and the hope to be able to do what I'm supposed to be able to do. To do the right thing. To be. I was reading that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous for years. And I said, "God, what do you want me to do? What do you want me to do? What do you want me to do?" And I couldn't stay sober. Because I was doing. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it says, to be what God wants me to be. To be what God wants me to be. To be the example. To have the compassion. To have compassion. To not belittle, to judge, condemn, but to have the compassion. To have the compassion for your pain. If there's anything I'm grateful for Al-Anon, you have taught me how to have compassion. To have the compassion for your pain. For years I looked in the families of eyes and they saw that contempt. And when all I saw was contempt, then I could have no compassion. When I sit down in a room full of you and I saw the unconditional love and I saw the release of live and let live and I felt the freedom to be what I always wanted to be. I knew that's what it is, to be what God wants me to be, not to do what God wants me to do. I can't figure that out. It's too big for me. But I can be what God wants me to be because I can understand by your example what direction I'm supposed to go, what time I'm supposed to be on, the patience. I've come to understand that love for a guy like me is an action. The first act of love is the act of transparency. And I've got to be transparent. What you see is what you get. That's me. I have no secrets. If I have no secrets, then I'm transparent. There's nothing going on in my life today that I can't stand here and shine the light on. The book tells me to share it in a general way, but I'm transparent. I have nothing going on in my life that I can't share with anybody. An amazing thing about that is if you have no secrets, there is no gossip. So I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to look over my shoulder anymore. I'm not treating anybody any way that I wouldn't want to be treated myself. One of the greatest things that Sue told me the other day, I was talking to her about the pain of these young people. They're going through, trying to go through things sober that I went through drinking. And they're sober and they've egos up and they're trying to go through these things and they're young kids. And Sue said, you know, one of the greatest things that this program's given you is a strength that when they choose to go out there and do what they have to do, you haven't had to chase them down and beg them to come back. God, what a thing. What an awareness. What an awareness. Because I've been able to walk through that pain of release and letting people do what they have to do. I haven't had to continue it by constantly begging to come back and do it my way. See, I don't have to beg anybody for this anymore. You've heard it here all weekend. If you want it, it's here. It's available to you. If you don't, then you're not through. That's what the book tells me. And I'm grateful that I'm through today. And what that's given me is the patience to endure my blessings. And you've given me many blessings. And I take that in all the gratitude, the friendship, the relationship, the longevity. I had a guy that I sponsored, and I loved him very much. We always laughed and yucked it up and had good times together, and he chose to go back out, and he's dead. And I think about it because I saw him shortly before he died, and he drank himself to death, and I saw him, and he was trying to sober up again, and he had a big Raj, and he said, man, we had some good times. I don't know why I can't capture that again. And I understood his pain because he was trying to reach back and grasp something. But I also knew, you know, the very simple thing. I said, Rod, you know something? You can never, I don't care wherever you go, if you choose to drink yourself to death, you can never take away those memories that you gave me of me and you going down this road laughing and yucking it up together. You can never take that away from me. And I'm not doing anything today or putting anything in me that's going to wash them away. They're mine. They're my gift. And therefore, I've been able to look at many things with that perception that you gave me something. Hold on to that time in your life when you were worth something. Build on it. Don't settle for the crackers and cheese. Don't settle for those things. Pay attention to your teachers because many of them try to teach you with ignorance. And they may love you, but that does not mean they're right. And when we look at our own self from that perception, that I say to me, I may not be right, but I know where there's teachers who are. God bless and thank you.